Morning, everyone. How are you all doing? Friday Homebrew Con, baby. Welcome to Homebrewing Experts Q&A. My name's Julia Herz. I'm the Executive Director of the American Homebrewers Association. And want to, just in case you haven't been in a session yet, let you know to move to the center of the aisle for microphone questions, especially since this is Q&A, and also, as you all should know, these are recorded. If your questions didn't get into the microphone, then the recordings for AHA members would not recapture a lot of the dialogue. So please go ahead and do that. Also, silence your cell phones. Want to remind you all, through homebrewersassociation.org, you have access to hundreds of amazing sessions, seminars that the AHA has cataloged over the years, including these sessions that you'll have access to after HBC. I also want to encourage you each to activate your homebrewersassociation.org account. That gives you access to your member card. That gives you access to member-only content. If anyone has any challenges ever with your online account access, we have a membership services team that stand ready via phone or email 5 days a week during business hours to help you on the fly as you email or ready right there when you call. So please don't feel like we're not available and able to help you in just a few minutes to get past any access questions. Also want to remind you to submit survey feedback. This is a very important process to us. It's your all's voice in the room, and these sessions were approved by member working group representatives. So please, as members, tell us how we're doing on all of this. And with that, I'm going to introduce Shauna Cormier, the chair of the AHA Governing Committee, as well as Seattle Beer School, and with the Washington State Brewers Guild, and she will introduce the panel that Shauna is also participating in. Thanks, y'all, for being here.
Thank you, Julia. Welcome, everybody. It's such an honor to be moderating this conversation. It's a conversation, so as Julia said, please come up to the mic. And we can talk about homebrewing. Does that sound good? Yeah, let's do it. So I feel like y'all don't need much of an introduction. Would you like to introduce yourselves, or do you want me to?
It sounds better if you do.
Do I sound good?
Yeah.
Okay. So we have John Palmer. You want to wave to everyone? Say hi. Interestingly enough, doesn't know that much about water. So don't ask him any questions about that. We have Gordon Strong, right? BJCP, Master of Masters? Is that, like, inaccurate?
President Emeritus.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And we have Brad Smith. Yes, hello. So I just kind of want to – I'm going to start off with kind of an easy question, but a fun one, I think. What is the first beer that you ever brewed, if you can remember?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to do a porter, but because I wanted to get some buy-in from my wife, I ended up doing an American light lager that turned out horrible. So that was the first beer.
Nice. I mean, whose first beer turned out perfect?
So she bought into that?
No, but at least, you know, it was a good excuse to try again.
my first beer was a Kit in 1995, maybe, English brown ale.
Nice.
Turned out well enough. My wife said, hey, this kind of tastes like beer.
Hey, that's a step in the right direction. You might want to go a little bit closer to the mic, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, cool. Brad?
I started in 1987.
Wow.
And the first beer I brewed was also an extract Kit. It was an Irish stout. And some of the bottles exploded in my kitchen and made quite a mess because I guess I didn't really know what I was doing carbonation-wise. But the beer was okay, and I made a lot of bad ones after that, so it was good.
Yeah, I feel like if a bottle hasn't exploded, then you're probably doing something wrong, right? Exactly. You can come right up and ask questions. If someone looks like someone's chopping at the bit, so please jump up. And don't be shy, reminder.
In order to get rid of chlorines from my water, I've been boiling the water before I put it into the mash and any later additions into the boil pot. Given that everything's going to get boiled in the boil pot, the wort, is that necessary? Am I doing this step when I don't really need to?
Okay, so Chlorine itself, the elemental chlorine when added for disinfection, will evaporate during the heating up and the boil. So, yeah, it's not necessary, but so many municipalities use chloramine, where they take the chlorine and combine it with amine or ammonia, and that does not boil out. And so you will get the chlorophenols in your beer if your municipality uses chloramine. So the easiest way to get rid of it is to use vitamin C or sodium metabisulfite, Camden tablets, and just, a couple grams of those compounds will treat 10, 20 gallons.
Very good. Thank you.
Cool.
I just buy RO water and don't mess around with that at all. That works too.
Just RO? Is that what
sure.
you said? Yeah.
Sure. Start and add what you need.
Cool.
Hi, Brad. You have an article about back sweetening as cider, but I want to go more detailed about it. So do you think it's better to crash cool the cider to stop everything? I mean, after the complete fermentation, and then do the chemicals, or you don't have to do the crash cool first.
So the question's about back sweetening, right? Cider. To back sweeten. And you said you were proposing to do a cold crash instead. The only problem with doing a cold crash is it doesn't necessarily stop the yeast. Yeah. If you warm it back up, the yeast is going to keep going.
Yes,
So typically, it's a combination of sulfite and sulfate.
I mean, and, the
sorry,
time
sulfate that stops.
Do you
it. Go
think,
ahead, I'm sorry.
Yes, the in that article, it's you said that do the sulfite first, and then the sorbate,
right.
One day afterwards, but. Do you think it's necessary to crash cold first, then do the chemicals?
Yeah, you certainly could do a cold crash first and then add the chemicals. I don't think that would be a problem. You do want to space out. Somebody taught me this. You do want to space out the sulfite and the sorbate. It turns out if you put them both in at the same time, sometimes you can get an odd off flavor out of it. But so generally, you want to put one in and then wait a few hours before you put the other one in.
Okay.
But a cold crash is perfectly fine beforehand, if that's what you're asking. Yeah.
And do you think it's just okay to sprinkle the powder in there, or it's better to pour some from the tap and mix them, blend it, and then pour it back?
As far as how to add the chemicals, I add them directly. I haven't had a real problem with it. But if you want to use a little bit of sanitized water or something like that just to make it easier to dissolve, that would be fine too. Either way works.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
How many cider effective. Makers do we have?
Yeah.
Nice. Cool.
Hi there. My brewing has evolved to the point now where I get most of the numbers and fermentation and qualities that I want, but I do a lot of beers that are supposed to be yeast focused, where the character comes from yeast phenols and things like that. But I'm brewing too clean now. So my question is, how do I stress the yeast or get Belgian-type yeast to put out the phenols and esters that a commercial example style would have.
What strain of yeast are you using, and what style are you trying to make?
Typically, the Belgian strain, so triples. How do I get the character like in a triple Carmelot, for example?
There are a lot of environmental factors that you can do to stress the yeast. Sure. There's a lot of factors that you can use to stress the yeast like that if that's what you want. I mean, underpitching, raising the temperature, playing with nutrients, things like that. But I think strain selection plays the most part into it, at least for me. So if I'm doing sort of Trappist-style Belgians, I'm really fond of the 3787 yeast or the White Labs equivalent, whatever that is, 530, I think. So that's what I tend to use. And you really can manipulate the profile quite a bit by just playing with temperature. White Labs, I don't know if they still have it, they published this chart that showed, you know, at sort of low temperature, medium temperature, and high temperature, what each of the yeasts sort of do with what it provides. But I know the 3787 yeast that I like, both Westmalle and Westvleteren use it, but they use it at very different temperatures. So you can, Westvleteren goes a lot hotter with the ferments. A lot of the Belgians, you know, when they talk of fermentation temperature, they're fermenting in sort of shallower tanks, so the fermentation dynamics are a little bit different. When you're fermenting in something sort of tall, you get more pressure on it, so you tend to get more ester development out of the shallower tanks. So there are a lot of variables to play with, but the very first one I would start with is the yeast strain. Maybe you're just using something that's a little bit too mild, because you don't really get those really complex characteristics out of sort of brewing in an unclean way, to sort of use what you're saying. You said you cleaned everything up really well. That's good. I think Belgians should be clean. They should have a lot of character, but they should have the character that you're expecting them to have, not a lot of sort of bonus character, you know, the along for the ride stuff. Yeah. So if you haven't used it before, I'd say 3787. It works for me in triples, doubles, lots of the Trappist styles.
What pitching rate do you usually use?
Did you hear the question? What pitching rate?
Pitching rate, whatever the, I don't intentionally underpitch. I mean, sometimes I underpitch if I'm making like Hefeweizen, but with, you know, it depends on the gravity. If I'll go a little bigger for a triple than I would for sort of a Trappist single, but if you're using the commercial packs. You know, I just tend to follow the manufacturer recommendations. Yeast companies are giving you a lot of yeast work with.
Sorry to interrupt. So I use 3787 quite a bit, and so if temperature is my biggest tool, would you say start higher than the 63, 64 at the low end, or
no,
start high or ramp to high, and how fast do I ramp?
So I don't use external temperature control on it. So I would pitch at 64 ambient, and with 3787, what I've experienced is that if you try to constrain the temperature, it'll just pack up its bags and go home. It'll just quit on you. So for me, that yeast, you want to let it run. You want to let it, you know, let it do its thing, let it free rise. And that helps give you good attenuation, because I think full attenuation is a really important character in the traditional Belgian styles. That's how they all are there.
Thank you.
Cool.
Good luck.
Thank you. Yeah, it feels like there's a lot of luck when it comes to Belgian styles, right? In some ways.
Just one minor point, but a lot of the yeast makers are starting to publish typical fermentation data. And so a lot of times you can find things like the ester content, the phenolic content, and so on for a typical fermentation. You have to dive down a lot of times into the website to find it, but you can actually get good fermentation data when you're doing your comparison and selection for the yeast.
Sorry.
Oh,
that's cool.
Thank you.
Hey, guys. I've been brewing for about 6 years now, and I got a lot of information from all three of you guys. I appreciate your contributions to the industry. My question to you is around astringency. My scorecards, I'm getting this underlying note, astringency, astringency, astringency. Now, things that I've already done to try to fix some of that is... To the mic, is that better? Okay, sorry, guys. Astringency is what I'm asking about. Things I've done to try to fix some of that in my brew house is open up the mill gap a little bit. Final runnings out of the mash is not below 1.010. Sparge water is below 6, and I'm still finding a little bit. Do you guys have any insights on where to look next?
What styles? All styles?
Yeah, pretty much all styles. More dominant in the big beers like Russian Imperials.
Yeah. What percentage of the volume are you sparging?
I would say probably around 40% of my total water volume will be in the sparge.
Yeah, I would cut that back.
Okay.
I would
higher grist ratio.
More grist, less efficiency, and less sparging.
Okay.
Would be one way to tackle it.
Okay.
Yeah, I kind of go along with that. You might want to, as sort of a experiment, try sort of a no sparge batch. Sort of, you know, set your favorite recipe software to about 60-ish%, and you know you wind up wasting a little grain, but then sort of mash thin and just run it out without sparging.
Okay.
And see if you still get that character, because then you would know it would be related to somehow over sparging. It could be something in the chemistry of your water. I don't know. You know what your profile is. I would say try RO water for virtually everything.
I live up in Seattle, and we have pretty soft water up there, and I filter it with a 3-stage carbon filtration, and then depending on the style, I'll kind of build up some minerals. But usually not too much, probably somewhere in the 50 to 100 parts per million in each category. But that's a great idea, is taking some of the sparge out.
So you mentioned all styles, right? Yeah. So
yeah.
Astringency is typically going to come from too much tannin extraction, which, of course, can happen during the sparge, and that's what they were talking about. If you got a pH meter, you can measure the water coming out of your mash tun when you're sparging.
Yeah.
General rule of thumb is you don't want that to go above 6.
Yeah,
if it goes above 6, you're going to get some tannin extraction. You can also get tannins out of hops, believe it or not. That's a polyphenol. Tannin is a polyphenol. So depending on what you're doing with your hops, you can get some astringency from that.
Okay.
And as they mentioned, if your water profile can also lead to a perception of astringency.
Yeah, it's a pretty light perception.
Particularly look at like sulfate to chloride ratio. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. I don't mean to speak over you. I thought you were done. I don't really pick up on much of it, so it questions my ability to even pick it up. But other people say that they can pick it up.
Yeah. Go ahead.
A lot of people perceive astringency and bitterness like the same way, because tannins are bitter as well as being astringent. Yeah, so you might want to they might be telling you that your beer is over bittered too. So
that tracks.
Try backing off on the BUs by 20% and see if you still get those kind of comments.
Okay, cool.
It's just. You're experimenting, so we've given you some ideas. So what I'd say is don't try them all at once. pick one and try that and see if you can't narrow it down. Then if you know which part of, whether it's something in ingredient handling or something in the process or whatever. It could be recipe formulation, like I said. Could be overbittered. Then what course of action you might take. But if you can try to isolate where the problem is, this advice works for virtually any problem. Just try to figure out where in the universe. Is not in sync for me at the moment. And then if you can focus on that piece, then you might be able to try some different things.
All right. Thanks for your time.
Good luck.
Thank you. It's nice that you were able to pinpoint. It was one thing, right? It was astringency. So now you can kind of, you know, use all these tools. Yes.
Hey, all. Can you hear me okay?
Oh, yeah.
All right. You know, thankfully where I'm at, I'm in Baton Rouge. We've got some pretty good water as a base. But I found on the more delicate beers, I'm looking to go more RO. So I'm kind of young and getting into that. I haven't seen a lot of just kind of base information about RO. I'm guessing that's still something you would need to send to Ward Labs to get off per your location. Or is there the general, is it like distilled, or how would that work in general?
Well, depending on how much, what the TDS is in your source water, kind of rule of thumb is that two passes on an RO system that you could get from Home Depot or something mm-hmm. will take out 90% of that.
Okay.
So generally, a couple passes through RO get you down below 10 ppm, you know, in all categories.
Close to zero.
Yeah, which is effectively distilled.
Okay.
10 ppm is not enough to really worry about. So, yeah, you can go ahead and just assume you have a clean slate at that point and add, you know, somewhere between 50 and 100 ppm of the species that you want to add. And if it's 50 versus 60, not a big deal.
Okay.
Are you building your own RO at home, or are you buying it?
So I was buying it, but obviously as a home brewer, you just overdo it. And we set up our own system. So now I have my own. Yeah.
Yeah, I buy it. The grocery store has it. And you know, the systems, you know, they work slow, and you have to have tanks to build up the supply you want. It just, you know, you have to maintain it. And, you know, I could buy 5 gallons for, you know, $1.95 or something, and, you know, grocery store 3 minutes from my house. So for me, that's what I do. And the RO machine has this, you know, 5-stage thing they go through. They, you know, carbon filter it twice. They UV it. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to play off of something that John said, because he said TDS, total dissolved solids.
Right.
That's what I get. That's what I use to just do a spot check when I buy our RO, like, because somebody else is maintaining it, and you know, maybe they haven't you know, flushed the filter recently, or you know, mm-hmm. you know, it's just mm-hmm. you know, it's like calibrating an instrument. So a TDS check of the water that you get for me is a quick check to see, did they really RO it? Because where I live, the water's horrible. It's full of all this stuff. So if I just hit it with TDS and it's like, you know, something approaching zero, good to go, and then I don't have to mess with it.
Awesome.
So I endorse that as it's a more
precise.
Yeah, it's not only more precise, it's if you have a pH meter, then you know you have to calibrate it, and you have to, you know, maintain it and things like that. TDS is just sort of electrical. It's like
conductivity.
Right. So you know, that is a quick check if you've sort of outsourced the production of the water.
Yeah.
I went to RO Water for the first time because the story I tell is I was spending more time making water than I was making beer. And you know, that's backwards.
Yeah.
I want to make the beer and then let my body make water out of it.
All right, so it sounds like I've got another meter to buy. So,
and the TDS meters are cheaper than pH meters.
Awesome. So
usually you get a multi tool.
Yeah, you can get one that's combined. And if your TDS is less than 100, then you're pretty good to go, because that's, you know, divided by 6 main elements. That's, you know, 10, 15 each, which is low.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, I love lagers, but I'm incredibly impatient. Now, I love the White Labs high-pressure lager yeast. Had varying success using other lager yeast for pressure fermentation. Which ones have you used that you like and have been very successful with?
This is a tough one, I guess. Huh?
No, it's the premise of the question is what I was struggling with, because I'm not a fan of pressure fermenting lagers. People say oh, I can't taste the difference. I can. So I tend to go old school on it. And, you know, if I've got a problem being impatient with the lager, then, you know, make a mild to drink while you're waiting for your lager. You know, make a good turn and burn style. You know, it's a good reason to have, like, a lot of kegs and, you know, some space. But I'm a big fan of the 3470 yeast in any form, liquid or dry. I think it's really easy to handle in a dry form. It's very repeatable. It ferments well. It doesn't throw a lot of sulfur. And I dislike sulfury lagers, so I tend to choose strains that have a low amount of sulfur. But I find the character improves if you actually go through the lager. It's all about the mouthfeel. It's not just about ester suppression.
Can you talk more about pressure fermentation?
I've never done it.
Yeah, neither have I. Who's pressure fermented before?
To be fair, I've actually not. Yeah, I actually haven't done any pressure fermentation myself, but I've had guests on the show that have talked about it at length. And from what they tell me, it is very strain specific. So some strains work. Some lager strains work well with pressure fermentation and don't necessarily throw the off flavors you're trying to avoid. And unfortunately, there's other strains that just don't work with pressure fermentation. Unfortunately, since I haven't done it myself, I don't know specifically which ones work and which ones don't, so I'm not really able to answer your question. But I mean, you can find sources online, people that have done it and had success with certain strains, and I'd probably stick to those strains is what I would do. So,
yeah, it's – the premise that I always get hung up on is that if you use it, it's just the same as – you know, doing the traditional way. I reject that premise. So everything that follows from that, I have sort of problems with. I mean, the theory is high pressure suppresses ester formation. You know, it's a fact, but
it's still a different fermentation and different beer.
Ester, you're stressing the yeast in a different way, and esters aren't the only things that yeast produce, and that's not the only sort of thing that you want or don't want in a lager. So it's. I appreciate trying to do something really fast, but I would just as soon use a very clean ale strain at a cool temperature if you really want to go fast, because I think the lager strains do need some time.
I just want to add one minor point. I had John Blickman and Chris White on one of my podcasts. You can probably look it up pretty easily. And they actually had detailed data because, of course, Chris White has access to his own lab. So that you can actually see that they did suppress the esters, but as he points out, the esters aren't the whole story because the rest of the flavor profile is there. But they had a lot of detail on it because they were able to do lab analysis on the results. So you might want to look at that if you haven't done it already. It's kind of interesting.
And the Blickman lives like 2 hours from me, so I tried the experiment that he did with, oh, he did this. He sort of showed up with things and says, you know, which of these do you prefer? And I pick the not pressure fermented one. I'm like, this one just doesn't seem smooth enough. Yeah. So it didn't really, my data point didn't sort of fit with his objectives, but I could tell the difference. I didn't prefer it. But if you can't tell the difference, you know, palates are, you know, very personal things. So so I haven't done it. I know how to do it. You know, like I said, the pressure will reduce ester formation. That is true.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Cool, thank you.
Thanks guys for being here. I'm kind of new to brewing. I started this last fall. I have an all-in-one system. And my question maybe goes more towards Brad, because I use your software to do all my beer recipes and figure things out. So one thing I always find with my all-in-one system is I'm always kind of missing my gravity targets. And I've tried to do things like increasing my, you know, grains and adjusting, you know, my sparge. I'm looking for any kind of ideas of how I can boost my efficiency in my brew house.
Well, I'll say two things. One is if your gravity's not on, you're probably your efficiency's too high or too low.
Okay.
So you can adjust that number so you can at least get to where you want to be as far as your original gravity. As far as improving efficiency, I used to be kind of obsessed with, you know, like, okay, I want to build a system that, you know, especially back in the day when we used to build a lot of systems by hand, you get kind of obsessed with, okay, I want to get, you know, the next couple percent of efficiency out of it.
Yeah.
As I've gotten older, my perspective's changed a lot because buying an extra pound or two of grain is really not that big a deal when you come right down to it. You know? It's a couple bucks compared to, you know, all the time you invest in actually creating a beer and all this other stuff. So as I've gotten older, I've gotten much less obsessed with having a super efficient thing. I'd rather just be able to dial in the numbers and go, okay, I know I'm going to hit my gravity because I've got X, you know. Even if, let's say, you know, my BrewEasy is not super efficient. I don't know about you guys, but
right.
I get, I don't know, like in the high 60s efficiency or something like that on it. But I've gotten to the point where I just don't worry about it.
Okay.
So I mean, you can. There are things you can do to improve your efficiency. Probably the biggest thing you can do to improve your efficiency would be to improve your grain crush because that's the biggest driver.
Yeah,
overall.
And I just bought my first mill, so I'm planning on starting to mill my own grain instead of depending on the
a lot of people get pre-crushed grains from various sources. Yeah. A lot of those grain mills run a lot of grain through them in a day, and so they're not necessarily ideally adjusted in many cases. So if you can afford a mill, that's a great investment because you can really dial it in then. And you want to dial it in so you get a really fine crush in the center of the grain. You're typically using a dual roller mill. And that you get large piece of husks in the outside of the grain.
Okay.
Honestly, the grain crush is probably the biggest thing you can do to increase your efficiency. There's five or six other things that you could consider. A lot of them have to do with equipment design and so on.
Yeah, I in my experience, the... you might want to increase the water amount in the mash so that you can more thoroughly mix.
Okay.
So
that was going to be a secondary question I had, which is, in all-in-one systems, it recirculates the water the entire time. And I know with John's videos, a lot of times it's just sitting in a mash tun warm, and it's just... It's not recirculating in that sense. Every once in a while, you might pour some on top. So I didn't know if it constantly moving and not giving it time to, like, the enzymes breaking down.
But just because it's moving doesn't mean it's moving where it needs to move.
Okay.
You know, you can easily create, if you're doing it too fast, you can easily create a single channel.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is that a thinner mash allows you to stir it more easily, so it needs to be fully hydrated because dry grain isn't going to convert no matter like what you do to it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're shoveling out at the end and you start seeing these white flowery things, you didn't stir it enough.
Okay.
So I tend to mash in sort of English style, like underletting. It gives sort of a more thorough hydration for me. So that's probably not available to you. So I would say go thinner, stir it, and then stir it a couple of times while you're mashing, because mash mixing, and you may also be getting, so I agree with the crush, so the hydrating the grain, the mixing of the grain, and you might want to check the calibration of your temperature reading devices. Because if you're mashing sort of out of the sweet spot for the enzymes, you know, you're not necessarily
converting.
Yeah, you're not really converting.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
If you're not making maltose, you know, you're not ultimately going to make beer. So you know, you got to be in the range for those sacrification enzymes.
Okay.
Yeah, I just want to add a couple things. There's a trade-off between the degree of crush and the amount of time it takes for that grist to hydrate, solubilize, and convert. Finer crush is going to give you a higher extract sooner than a coarser crush, which will take more time to fully hydrate and be able to extract from. But the trade-off from there is your lautering. And as you sparge and how much you're sparging, or draining in a, you know, like in a no-sparge case, a very fine grist is not going to get the flow through the grain bread, and you may end up leaving more wort behind and suffering from efficiency that way.
Okay. Or you get a stuck sparge.
Stuck sparge, yeah.
Then all your time savings just went out the window.
Yeah. And going back to what they said as well, as far as higher water to grist ratio, I always advocate more like a 2 quarts per pound water to grist versus the 1 or 1.5. You get a very thick, you know, high gravity wort at a lower water to grist ratio. But when you have the higher water to grist, 2, even 3 quarts per pound, I think is not out of the realm. You have more room for extraction, less inhibition from the sugars created. You know, you don't have the concentration gradient in that sense.
Okay. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, I also have a all-in-one as well. And so everything you're saying, the experimentation I've done, because I've also struggled with efficiency, and I used to be very obsessed with it and like, oh, no, I'm failing. And then I was like, I'm homebrewing. It's going to be okay.
Just figure out
number
is for you and then use that number next time.
Exactly. We're all unique in our own efficiencies, right?
Yeah.
But stirring was a really huge one, right? You get those clumps, and it's not good. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Hi there. One of the things I really like to brew is Czech Pilsners.
Could you speak a little louder?
One of the things I really like to brew is Czech Pilsners. First few batches, I used 100% Pilsner malt grain bill. Obviously, had some issues with head retention, so I added some carapils to my last batch. Not surprisingly, head retention was better, but then you had the clarity issues. Any tips and tricks on the balance of head retention, clarity in a Czech Pilsner?
What style
are you brewing?
Czech Pilsner.
No, please.
Okay. So head retention. The carapils, you know, doesn't have any more protein than the base malt. So what's your mash schedule like for your Czech Pils?
On the spot.
What's that?
I said you're on the spot.
Yeah, yeah. I'm drawing a blank, but
I mean, are you in a single temp or a multi-step?
It's usually single temp and then just mash out.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, a common problem with people doing Czech Pils is they try to do the full multi-step, you know, starting at body temp and working their way up, and that can tend to degrade a lot of protein, which can cut your head retention significantly. It'll form up really quick and then fade really quick.
Yeah.
Also fade really quick if, you know, you have a high lipid load. That can come from being on the yeast too long, some, you know, autolysis or, you know, type issues with lipids. What's the behavior of your foam at the moment?
The last batch, which with the carapils it did, the foam was retained more. Earlier batches, you know, it was just foamed and then it kind of settled.
Almost like
a Coca-Cola where you have the foam and then it just kind of bubbles away.
Mm. Okay, yeah, it sounds like a lipid problem. And or dirty glassware too. That's always the culprit that could hang in the wings.
I just want to add, so if you get a chance, go listen to, I think it's a Pope of Foam kind of episodes with Charlie Bamforth. I did a couple of them with him, and he goes into excruciating detail on head retention and where all the stuff comes from. He's one of my favorite guests. He's written a book on foam, just to give you an idea. So just on foam.
Best
so,
book out there, right?
Yeah.
But anyways, the interesting thing is head retention primarily comes from proteins and polyphenols. Clarity is hurt by proteins and polyphenols.
Right.
So there's always a balance there, yeah. Right? Because if you add more protein to your beer, it's going to have much better head retention, but it's going to hurt it's going to hurt overall clarity. So So there is a balance there, and finding that balance can be difficult depending on the style and so on. There's other tricks you can use. You can drive the carbonation level up a little bit, mm-hmm. which a lot of lagers, and if you've ever been to Europe, where it takes sometimes 2 or 3 minutes to pour, Germany, where it takes two or three minutes yep. to pour a lager, that's because they're serving it at probably 4 or 5 volumes of CO2. Mm-hmm. And then, just look at all those things. You know, we mentioned contamination for lipids is a real problem, but there's you've got to balance the polyphenols and the proteins that you're using. Proteins, of course, come from malt. Polyphenols come from both malt and from the hops that you're using. So, so that's the balance.
All right.
But go listen to those episodes. They're actually excellent.
Cool. Most people don't like to go for this, but I would also say that the Czechs use a more intensive mash schedule for those kind of beers, and that actually has something to do with the results. So, I don't know if you're down for decoctions, but...
Some of my earlier batches I did decoction. I'm using an all-in-one.
It's a commitment.
Yeah. Now I use an all-in-one.
Yeah.
Haven't quite figured out how to decoct in an all-in-one, so...
Harder. Yeah, hot plate.
You might try adding some flaked barley or to the mash, and then doing a protein rest on that mash, and that would provide more protein and substrate for the foam.
Yeah, it's not like traditional,
right?
But yeah, I was going to say something like that. A different form of bodybuilding thing. If I have clarity problems with a Pilsner, I usually throw in like a 10-minute rest at about 131.
Okay.
But I agree with like adding something. You want these medium weight molecular proteins to like give you the give you the structure for the head.
And then of course there's a whole variety of findings you can use as well to help aid in the clarity and drop a lot of the proteins out and the polyphenols out. So you can use them at every stage in brewing, basically. So
okay.
Thank
cool.
you.
Great stuff. Thanks.
Good luck. Thank you. Yes, you want a crystal clear Czech Pilsner, right? But head almost seems more important in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just obsessed with foam,
right.
But
drink it from a stein.
Yeah. Are you drinking from a stein? That might be the problem. Yeah. Yes.
So I got a question about mash water and pH. Nowadays, I usually deoxygenate my mash water with yeast and sugar on the night before. And that process usually drops the pH of my mash water. I usually don't care about it because I think that it doesn't mess the alkalinity. Am I right there, or should I think about my pH of my mash water?
No, usually the pH of your mash water doesn't matter. It is lower, but when you add it to the malt, the buffering of the malt is going to
change it.
So your water source, is that a high alkalinity source, low alkalinity source?
Low.
Yeah. Then I wouldn't worry about it at all.
Thank you, guys.
Sure.
Cool.
Hey, good morning, everybody. This is a question for the whole panel. So I have been trying for years now to control for sulfur in my Weiss beers, and I've tried warm fermentation temperatures, open fermentation, taking a look at my water, time and temperature, just letting it ride in the primary for a month, and every single time I end up having to use copper and, mm-hmm. sometimes like blowing CO2 through the dip tube. So if you have any thoughts about how I can control for sulfur, that'd be great.
Cool. Sulfur, your favorite, Gordon?
The sulfur is my favorite, not in lagers, but in a Weiss beer, you say?
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of the cooler ferments. I'm talking about like pitching close to 60 and, let it rise. It was actually in San Diego. I was on a panel with that Harold Gudbranson did, I think it was in 2011. And we really preferred the beers that were made, started cold. What yeast strain are you using?
It's either Imperial Stefan or Weihen Stefan from Y Yeast.
Yeah, 3068 yeah. kind yep. of. Yeah. Well, that's the one to use. You know, go cold, don't over pitch, don't oxygenate. You want to sort of under pitch that a little. If you have you know, sort of an open ferment, you want to avoid pressure on the yeast to let the esters develop. The counterintuitive thing is, like, people think like warmer temperatures, like, you know, cause more yeast activity, and, you know, that's true. But my very first comment is about, like, you know, clean yeast. So the yeast that have the profile that you want and don't bring along all this other stuff. When I tasted the warmer fermented wheat beers, they just seemed dirtier to for the lack of something, you know, like dishwater kind of flavor. It didn't have the clean, pure flavors I was looking for. Because people would just say, oh, if you want a more estery beer, you ferment warmer. Yeah, kind of. But, you know, yeast are gonna bring along, you know, their buddies. So, you know, you got to be careful about that. I don't know that I've, you know, maybe it's, is everybody saying sort of sulfury? How are you perceiving it? Is it like eggy or?
Burn match.
Yeah. What kind of sulfury are you getting?
Yeah, definitely eggy.
Eggy. Oh.
I don't know if this factors into it, but I do have alkaline and high bicarbonate water, and I try to cut that with distilled. And I'm also using a Cambin tablet overnight.
Okay, well, the Cambin tablets are adding sulfites to the water. And if you're adding too much, then all that sulfite is not getting converted to sulfate. So that
inhibits, yeah.
Yeah, so you could be getting some extra sulfite that could be converted into sulfide that way. What's your base malt?
It's about like 50% wheat malt and the rest Pilsner malt. Sometimes I'll play around with the malt profile and throw in 5 to 10% malted oats for fun.
German malts?
It really runs the gamut. German, American, whatever's on hand.
Okay. That's kind of where I was leading up to, is sulfur compounds often come from the synthesis of amino acids during the lag phase. So depending on, you know, if you're using the same base malt time after time that you're getting this sulfur character, it could be an amino acid deficiency in that particular base malt with the particular yeast strain that you're using, because that's the trade-off there, the symbiosis. But if you're using variety and still getting that character, then maybe it's not the amino acid necessarily. It may be too much Camden or other factors that I'm just not thinking of at the moment.
Thanks, everybody.
I sort of wonder about over-pitching maybe and whether you just have a lot of yeast there because, you know,
Yeah.
Sulfury is sometimes the way that people describe yeasty. So if there's a lot of yeast there and it's fresh, that can often, you know, I think of fresh pilsners and things will often have an eggy kind of character.
I've experimented with the.
Does it fade out with it? It should fade out with time. Is it fading out with time as you let it age?
It does. It definitely does. Yes.
One. I like that you bring up the sensory aspect of it, right? And how we oftentimes can confuse things that and people perceive things differently. So it's always a good idea to make sure that you're constantly calibrating your palate and what other people are telling you, right? Because it could be sulfur, maybe it's not. Maybe it's a combination. Yeah.
Thank
good
you all
luck.
For your time.
We have about 10 more minutes, so if you have a question, please line up.
Hi. So my question's related to Belgian styles, in particular, brewing a Saison. So one of the things that I've been struggling with is I have not wanted to use STA-positive strains because I don't want them in my equipment, and I'm concerned about my ability to clean them out afterwards if I want to do a non-expressive beer or non-super attenuated beer. But that leads me to how I can drive higher attenuation through my mash regime. So do you have suggestions on how I can get sub 10-10 on a mash regime using a yeast that might not be diastatic as positive?
Sugar in the grain bill.
Okay.
Step mash.
So what you? Yeah.
I yeah, go ahead. Can you? What steps would you? Would you do the typical 50, 60, 70 kind of regime, or what are you? When you say step, the other thing I've played with a little bit is
You want it in centigrade or Fahrenheit?
Fahrenheit's fine. Yeah.
I usually do like 131, 144, 158, 168, something like that.
You're definitely going to get more attenuation with that.
Okay. And are you sticking at 144 for like 40 minutes and the others are 20-minute steps? Or are you?
Usually, the 131 or 55C. No, I usually go 10, 15 tops. But you're right. I usually spend most of the time 144, 146. That's going to give you the most maltose. And then depending on how much body you want, you adjust the time at like 158. But I use that kind of mash schedule a lot for like, I use it for Saisons, I use it for German lagers. I also wrote about like doing this sort of starting warm and then letting it cool down and then bringing it back up. So it's kind of like a sort of continuous step. And I got a super dry beer out of that.
That's the round trip.
That's what I wrote about. But I did use the 3711 yeast on that. So, that could have had something to do with it as well. Okay. But I finished at 1.002 with zero sugar. So.
Wow.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's like a 155, let it drop down to 144 and just keep spinning it?
I started at 155, dropped it to 140 just by recirculating it, letting it cool at air temperature. And when it hit there, I kicked it on and like took it back up to mash out temperature. Slowly, slow ramp. But like I said, I use the 3711 yeast, and if you want to, and that has the characteristic that you're worried about. So, but I really like that yeast in a Saison.
Okay.
Because it works at like room temperature. You don't have to do the DuPont nonsense with it just take, I'd rather make sake than like use that yeast. It just takes constant tending. Buy a separate set of equipment just for that if you're worried about.
Yeah, hit the expo hall, buy a new setup. It's no big deal.
Thanks for the session, guys. My question is about a boil. I've got an all-in-one system, but I like to brew indoors. I'm in Georgia, sometimes it's too hot. So I built a steam condenser hood. And what I've noticed is I can either get a simmer or a very violent boil, and I can't get it, really anywhere in between without a steam burn, all right, and some cursing. So my question is, what I want to try to do is find a temperature where I'm getting kind of a simmer rather than this violent boil. And it's like when I pull the hood off, I mean, my hops are, kind of up into the pipe works. So number one, do I really have to have that violent boil, or is a simmer enough for 60 or 75 minutes? And the second question is that violent boil giving me some off flavors, like I'm doing anything from a Munich Dunkel to a pale? I've heard both sides, yes, you need it, or no, you don't. So what do you guys say?
I would say, yeah, go ahead.
again, the question presents a premise that I realize that you sort of have this, you know, is the car stalled or is it falling off a cliff? You know, and the right answer is in between there. And like, I would spend more of the time trying to troubleshoot your system to see how you could get a reasonable boil, because if a violent boil is causing problems, then, you know, don't do that. But you do need more than a simmer.
Right, right. And I guess the problem that I could probably spend more money, but I've got about a 5 degree. So if I set it, say, for 212, 213, it'll get up there and it'll begin to boil, and then it'll drop off until it goes down to about 208. And I'm using like an ink bird, you know, to do it. So if I could spend more money and maybe try to get more fine control, but is it worth it?
I don't know, but I would just say, you know, vigorous boil is not necessarily going to hurt you, but obviously if you're pushing all the hops up into the pipework, you got a real problem
right,
there. So
right.
That's the challenge. Yeah. I don't know why. I guess you probably ought to look at what's causing the actual problem, though, because are you creating a pressure vessel by effectively doing the steam system?
Yeah, I've got a hood on it, and it comes out, and I've got a sprayer, you know, at the top of a column, and so the steam goes out this 2-inch pipe, and then the sprayer is knocking it back down to water, and then I'm just recirculating that. But I'm sure there's a little bit of pressure there, and you can see the steam coming out. But if I check it, you know, when it's boiling, you know, it's always pretty hard. But it's, you know, I can't check it all the time because it's covered, so I can't really tell if I've got a simmer or if I've got a boil, except for the amount of steam coming out.
Yeah. Yeah, I do want to caution you in terms of you can boil too hard and too highly thermal load the wort, and you're going to get, faster staling and more, you know, off-flavor compounds generated, lower, you know, shorter shelf life due to that.
Yeah.
Simmer, yeah, is not quite enough, but you do want
a rolling boil.
There is a sweet spot in between the points you mentioned.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
So, yeah, I mean, like my all-in-one, you just turn it on and not worry about, like, a set temperature, but just give it a power level like 70-75%, and you know, I find that it maintains a rolling boil, you know, where you can see the surface, you know, moving and transferring. It's not leaping out of the pot.
I mean, how big is the system? Is it?
It can do 7.5 gallons. It's a magic
7.5 gallons.
So
yeah,
I'm
so it's fairly sizable, but.
Yeah.
I mean, I might want to look at some other design just to get the steam outside. It turns out the volume of steam you need to move is not very large, really, in general. It's
right.
Just you probably don't want to, you know, going into your drywall or whatever is the problem. But
I'm going to interrupt just really quickly. I'm going to interrupt just really quickly. We have 2 minutes, and
go
I want
ahead,
to be make sure. No, don't apologize. I just want to make sure we get the last two questions up here.
Got it. Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
You.
Good afternoon. I'll try to be quick on this. A couple of years ago, I started. My wife bought me a Mr. Beer kit. That's how I started. It's become an obsession, and I've done pretty well. I even have a beer in the competition here.
Congrats.
What drives me nuts? I have a Brewzilla. My mash temperatures are never consistent across the diameter of the thing. It drives me nuts. Am I overthinking this? No. I'm shooting for 151 and I get 154 on this side and 149 on the other, am I obsessing?
No, you're understirring.
The theme is understirring.
Yeah,
I
give a talk about that, about what temperatures your mash. If you have a long, I've got a long probe thermometer, and you know sometimes they do a demonstration. I just sort of move it around. It's like, tell me what the mash temperature is, and you know it's like 20 degrees different. So stir, 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 stir. Okay. Try to get it more uniform. It's not going to be the same. So
see, I needed to hear that from an expert. So
try, you know, think of, you know, there's a range of temperatures in a curve, and you want the center of the curve where the most points are to be somewhat close to where you want to be.
Unfortunately, these recirculating mash systems, they tend to channelize too. They tend to force all the wort through one channel, and so you end up with hot spots just because of that. So,
yeah. I do stir, and I've gone to a thinner mash, which has brought the range, you know, a little closer. So, but still, it's not consistent, and that's been driving me nuts.
But what he said, if you're recirculating while you're doing this, you might want to slow down the rate, because going too fast can give you the opposite result than what you want, because it'll channel. All right. You don't want the Grand Canyon in your mash tun.
Yeah, I had a question about doing like two-stage starters.
Two-day starters, that we said?
Two-stage. Yeah, I recently started freezing yeast into tubes, and then so I'll start out with about 8 milliliters of slurry. So if I want to make a starter for a lager and I need to end up with like 4 liters, do I want to make the first one? Like, how big do I want to make the first one into the second one? Or do I make the, because I've messed around with the starter tab on the Beersmith, and you can mess around with those numbers. So you can make the first one really big, and then the second one you don't have to make it as big. Or how would you recommend going about doing the two stages?
So I'm trying to remember the exact pitch rate, but slurry is typically not much different than the yeast that you buy off the shelf. Now, there's some exceptions to that, like White Labs, they will get a few more cells into a milliliter than some of the other. But in general, it's going to be very similar volume-wise. So if I collect, you know, 100 milliliters of slurry, that's equivalent to a 100 milliliter package of yeast that you might buy off the shelf, roughly. Okay, I think it's about 1 million cells per milliliter I can't remember the exact numbers, but anyways. You can use that as a basis. And actually, I had Chris White on a couple weeks ago. I don't mean to keep pushing the podcast, but I had Chris White on a couple weeks ago, and he actually talked about it and walked through all the numbers for repitching. So that would give you a very good estimate of what your starting volume, based on if you got a given volume of yeast, give you a very good estimate, and again, I don't remember the number off the head, top of the head, but a very good estimate of how many cells you have in that. And so then you could use any of the pitching calculators online or mine or whatever to then estimate what the size of the starter needs to be for the first stage and the second stage to get to whatever size you want to be. So that's or you can walk over and ask Chris what the number is, but it's I can't remember. It's so many million cells per milliliter you basically get in general. And that's sort of a general number that works really well overall. So that's what I would start with. Okay? But I was surprised. Okay. If you collect yeast from the bottom of your fermenter, it's actually very close to what you get if you buy a package of yeast. Right. It doesn't have nearly as long a shelf life, okay, so you want to try and use it soon. But you get a similar number of cells for a given volume. So that's kind of nice, you know. Okay.
Cool.
Okay.
Well, we're a little over time, so I'm going to wrap it up. But thank you, and thank you, everyone, for all your amazing questions. Thank you, Gordon, Bradley, and John. Enjoy the rest of your conference.